arms of mine. They are lonely, lonely and feeling blue.
That's a cut from These Arms of Mine, one of many hits recorded by the incomparable Otis Redding before his untimely death at the age of 26 in 1967. Redding's authentic style of soul music lit up the 1960s, bringing a new sound to the scene that resonated around the world. He's known today as a pioneer of soul music, but you can't think of Otis Redding without wondering what could have been. Author Jonathan Gould's 2017 biography of Redding is titled Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. The book is now out in paperback, and Jonathan Gould joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Anne.
Otis Redding was born in Georgia. Tell us about his background, because I think one of the best parts of your book and any great, you know, biography is the times in which he grew up, and you go way back.
Yes, I do. Well, Otis was born in 1941 in a small town called, outside actually, of Dawson, Georgia, in the southwest corner of the state, and his family moved to Macon in the center of the state when he was about a year old. But the important part of that is that he grew up as a young African American in the Jim Crow South at the height of what we now look back on as the Civil Rights era. And his career and the progress of the civil rights movement were just about were parallel in many ways. And one of the things that I wanted to do in the book was to give a clear idea of what life actually was like for someone in Otis's position and in Otis's family's position in that era. I think we all have a We all feel that we have some awareness of that, but of what the South was like for Black people in the Jim Crow era. But as I did my research, I came to understand that we really don't. We have no idea of what the social and psychological pressures of living in that environment were. And so I made a strong effort to try to describe what it was like, not just for Otis and his family, but for the vast majority of Black people in the South during that period.
You're right. So many layers upon layers of issues, everything from just daily life. There's a really interesting part where you're talking about when they moved from where he was born to where he grew up in Macon. They moved from a very largely rural atmosphere, which had one set of sort of rules and regulations, into this more urban or suburban type of setting, which had a whole bunch of rules and regulations.
Yes, exactly. Well, also, I mean, in many ways, the reason for the move, mm-hmm. Otis had three older sisters. He was the firstborn son of his family, but he had three older sisters. His parents were sharecroppers. That's the way they began. They very like almost everybody else who sharecropped. They were eager to find some other way to make a living, particularly his father, Otis Sr. Wanted his children to have an education. It's hard to overstate the emphasis that Black families in this, that uneducated Black families in the South or Black parents in the South placed on the idea of education in that generation. And so the real reason for moving to Macon, aside from the fact that it was a more vital economic center than Dawson, had to do with the fact that there was a high school there for Black students. In Dawson, there was no such thing. In Dawson, no Black child could go past the seventh or eighth grade in school, and Otis's father wanted his daughters to become school teachers, which he regarded as the ultimate profession, especially, I guess, for a young woman at that time. Mm-hmm. And so they moved to Macon because there was a high school where, beginning with Otis's older sister Louise, who was a wonderful source for this book, where she could get an education that would allow her to become a teacher. And that right there says so much about, I guess, about that world would be, you know, and the world that they were coming from in that way.
There's a photograph in the book of Otis Redding as a youngster, and you refer to it as, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but something to the effect of, this is the picture of a child who is well-loved, in you know, the Jim Crow South, that he had a certain confidence. And I don't like to use the word swagger. He was just a kid, but it was an innocent confidence.
Yes, I think that's right. And an important dimension of Otis's life is that he was well-loved. He came from a dynamic, dignified, two-parent household. His father had ambitions of his own. He eventually went on to become a deacon in his church, and then eventually a preacher. He was an ordained minister later in Otis's life. And Otis's mother, Fanny, everybody agrees was a formidable woman with that nobody, I mean, took no guff from anybody as far as this goes. And in all of their children, I think they instilled a sense of particularly emotional confidence, and that's why I describe him as well cared for and well loved.
Yeah.
Again, it was an existence that was impoverished by any standard that we could use, but it was not emotionally impoverished, and it was not in some ways, it was not culturally impoverished either, because they had the church, and the church was the great institution, the great cultural as well as religious institution of black life in that generation, particularly in the South, but in the North as well. And this is what their lives revolved around. And so it was not a culturally impoverished existence. It was an economically impoverished existence.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the inimitable Otis Redding. My guest is Jonathan Gould. He's the author of the biography, Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. It was published in 2017. It just came out in paperback. If you have a question for Jonathan Gould, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did Otis Redding survive the Jim Crow South? And that said, he lived there his whole life. He did not move to Hollywood. He didn't move to New York City. He kept his family there and brought all of his great wealth there as well.
Yes, well, and that was a notable characteristic of him. Otis grew up in a town, Macon, Georgia, that produced two other great music stars. Little Richard came from Macon, and James Brown, while he didn't come from Macon, really began his career there in a serious way and lived there for a number of years in the 1950s. Both Little Richard and James Brown, as soon as it was economically possible for them to move away, moved away. Macon was not a place that they had any desire to stay in. Otis was different. Otis, though, again, it wasn't his birthplace, it was the place of his upbringing, mm-hmm. felt an enormous loyalty to Macon, felt an enormous loyalty to Georgia and to the South. This was his home. And there was a part of his personality and of the ambition that was formed in that personality to establish himself there, to make it there, as opposed to do the thing that literally millions of black people from the South did, which was to leave at the first opportunity in generation after generation. And I think that in a funny way, this was one manifestation of what I describe in Otis as his devotional personality. Anybody who's heard his music, of course, I think would know what I'm saying when I talk about the devotional aspect of his singing, but it went deeper than that, or it was broader than that. Otis was a person who was devoted to the place where he grew up. He was devoted to his family. He was devoted to the people in his life. This is not to say that he was unerringly loyal, by the way, but the larger part of his makeup was that was, as I say, this sense of connection and this sense of a larger loyalty to his roots in that way. And it's, for me, it was very interesting to see the way that quality infused his artistic makeup and this amazing vocal persona that he developed as a singer.
And by the way, we're talking about somebody who died when he was 26 years old. I've seen the rare interview with him with Dick Clark. there's not a lot about him, as you make the point of saying. I mean, he didn't live long enough. He never made it to the Ed Sullivan Show, but he was scheduled to be on it. He seemed, though, when I even saw him in that interview with Dick Clark, like such an old soul.
Yes. It's there in his voice, and I think it was there. I mean, you asked, how did he survive the Jim Crow South?
Yeah.
Let's go back to that.
Yeah.
Briefly, in one sense, one of the things that everybody who knew him commented about in Otis's case was, including his manager, who was a young white college student from Macon named Phil Walden, who went on to become even better known as the manager of the Allman Brothers Band and sort of the czar of Southern Rock in the 1970s. But Phil was a young man, young white man, or beginning as a young white teenager in the South, who was drawn to black music very passionately. And Phil once said that he thought that Otis was probably the most intelligent person that he'd ever met in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all the more interesting because Otis was not particularly well educated. He dropped out of high school after in the middle of his sophomore year. So when we talk about intelligence, we're not talking about the usual markers of intelligence that we might apply to somebody who's, you know, sort of has a large vocabulary and has a great range of knowledge and things like this. But there was Otis had an acute intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and Phil referenced it in terms of his ability to learn something from a single explanation. If you showed him anything, from that point on, he remembered what you had told him, what you had shown him, and he knew how to do it. And his sister Louise said the same thing about him as a child. That she said that nobody ever taught him anything. He just seemed to know how to do things in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So one way that Otis survived the Jim Crow South was by drawing on his intelligence. And an important aspect of his intelligence for any black person in the South was the ability to, so to speak, read white people, to understand what their motives were, what their intentions were, and in effect to navigate them. And this, I don't mean to make this sound as if it was a form of manipulation, although it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to describe it that way, because you're talking about people. Let's talk about the alternative. To make serious mistakes in your navigation,
mm-hmm.
of white people, particularly as a young black man in the South, could cost you your life.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at, let's say, a white woman in the wrong way or spoke to her in the wrong way, you were in a type of jeopardy that most of us can't even imagine in that sense, in that period, in that place, in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Otis used his intelligence to and his ability to read people and so on and so forth to navigate them. And since most of the people that he needed something from in his career, especially in the early days of his career, were white, that social intelligence, I guess is the way I would describe it, served him extraordinarily well. And it enabled him to form relationships with people first like Phil Walden and later on with the people who owned Stax Records in Memphis and later on with people like Jerry Wexler, who was instrumental in Otis's career. And Wexler was the great sort of vice president of Atlantic Records, who probably had more to do with the successful commercialization of soul music than anybody else in the 1960s, with the obvious exception of Berry Gordy at Motown.
Everybody likes to learn something new when they read a biography, and one thing that seems like kind of prosaic that I learned was that he wrote Respect. Aretha Franklin made it super crazy famous, but he wrote it. I wanted to listen to that song as we head out of this segment. And my guest is Jonathan Gould, author of Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. It is now out in paperback. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Here's Respect by Otis Redding.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. That's a bit from Otis Redding's iconic performance of Shake at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. There was a bit of concern at the time about how Redding and his band would go over at the Summer of Love event, the first Monterey Pop Festival. But not to worry, he was a hit. Redding died that same year. He was 26 years old. Today we're talking about the life and legacy of Otis Redding. Still with us by phone is the author of the 2017 book, Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life, now out in paperback, Jonathan Gould. Jonathan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me once again.
You opened the book with a quote from Bob Weir, the rhythm guitarist in the Grateful Dead. Tell us about that and why you decided to start the book that way.
Well, the quote from Weir, first of all, it's coming from Bob Weir, and it's coming at, who went on to become an extremely well-known figure in right. certain music circles. Basically, what he had to say was, I was pretty sure that I'd seen God on stage, and what the what that quote conveys is the incredible impact of Otis's performance at Monterey. He was not unknown to that crowd in San Francisco or to parts of that crowd. Mm-hmm. Otis had played at the Fillmore a few months before in December 1966. And Bill Graham, who of course was the great impresario of the Fillmore and in some ways the great impresario of 1960s and 70s rock, Graham later wrote in his memoir that Otis's performance at the Fillmore in December 1966 was simply the best gig that he ever put on in his life. And considering all of the people that Bill Graham presented over the 20 years of his career, that's a pretty major statement. At any rate, the important thing about Otis, having said that he was familiar to many of the musicians who were at Monterey, like the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead.
What a lineup.
Disco bands. Many of the people in the audience, however, knew him. Even if they knew him, they had never experienced anything like him live. And the important thing about Otis live was that he was extraordinarily dynamic. And he also, he was a different kind of black performer to some extent than most people had seen. Otis was, though he learned the knee of James Brown, for example, many black performers, all of the Motown groups, for example, James Brown, Jackie Wilson, people like that, these were all extraordinary showmen. And one of the things they all had in common was that they were great dancers. I mean, James Brown may have been, along with Michael Jackson, simply the best, the best dancer that black music has ever produced. But this was part of their persona on stage. They were enormously polished. Otis was not like that at all. Otis was a country boy in some ways, and played that up on stage. It was a joke among his contemporaries that he was a terrible dancer, despite the stereotype of all black people knowing how to dance. By the way, his inability to dance was shared by two of his greatest contemporaries. One was Sam Cooke, who did not move well on stage, but learned to compensate for it. And the other was Marvin Gaye, who, despite all of the efforts of Motown's Charm School, was also simply known as a poor dancer. But Otis played up his awkwardness on stage, and it had a very interesting effect, which is that by playing up his awkwardness, it emphasized his naturalness. And by emphasizing his naturalness, it emphasized his sexuality. Yeah. Almost everybody who saw him found him to be an almost unaccountably sexual performer in terms of what he gave out on stage. There was nothing very crass about it. There was nothing vulgar about it or anything like that. It was simply that he was a big, 6'2", good-looking black man who carried himself with a kind of maybe swagger, but maybe just also sort of loose-limbed sort of quality that women found absolutely enthralling, and men too, obviously. And so, in terms of what came across when Otis walked out on stage at Monterey in front of an audience where he just looked like nobody else there. He performed like nobody else there. And that, combined with the incredible professionalism of both his own singing and the band that was backing him up. And the interesting thing about Monterey was it was one of the few occasions. Monterey was one. The European tour that he did a few months before was the other. It was one of the few occasions that he was backed up by the great studio band, Booker T and the MGs, that he made records with but did not perform with for the most part. He performed with his own road band, which was perfectly adequate and in some incarnations was extremely good. But nobody really could touch the sort of musical dynamics of Booker T and the MGs. They were simply, again, along with the Motown studio band, they were simply one of the great R&B bands of their generation. And so the impact of all of this was simply overwhelming, especially in a context where so many of the San Francisco groups, and I have some fun with this because most of them were very early in their careers, mm-hmm. but, you know, these were bands that would come out and would tune for 5 minutes on stage. You know what I mean? While everybody sat there.
Yeah, tortured, and yeah.
You know, this did not happen with Booker T and the MGs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tortured musicians, the tortured artistes. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the inimitable Otis Redding with the biographer, Jonathan Gould. His 2017 biography of Otis Redding is now out in paperback. It's titled Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's go a little bit back in time. How did Otis Redding break out of the small town life that he lived? I know he probably sang in the choir, or he sang with did a quartet, right, with some other guys there.
Yeah, he formed a gospel quartet with some friends of his in the housing project that he lived in, which was called Tyndall Heights. One of the great musical influences on Otis's whole generation of particularly black male singers, but female singers also, of which Aretha, of course, was the apotheosis, was gospel music. It goes without saying, but particularly gospel quartet, because gospel quartet was the main male form of gospel singing that came up, developed over the course of the 20th century, and in the 1940s, gospel quartet there was a revolution in black sacred music that took place in the 1930s around the work of a composer and pianist named Thomas Dorsey, who's best known for writing Precious Lord, which is one of the most incomparable gospel tunes ever written, obviously. But Thomas Dorsey revolutionized black sacred music in the 1930s. He was a former blues pianist who brought blues and jazz rhythm strongly into gospel music and also brought a personalized quality into black sacred music that hadn't been there before. You know, if you listen to the spirituals, they're all of these Old Testament sort of. They're all based on Old Testament sort of stories and so on and so forth. Precious Lord, on the other hand, is a direct address from a believer to God. Mm-hmm. And that same personal quality, of course, is exactly what exists in secular popular music, except people are not singing to their God, they're singing to their beloved. Well, Dorsey sort of expanded on this, and one of the effects one of the results of this revolution was this explosion in what we call gospel quartet. And so many black male singers of the 1960s, beginning with Sam Cooke, who actually was an enormous gospel star before he was a secular star, and people like Marvin Gaye and you name it, they all got their start in singing in quartets, and often singing in quartets in church, as far as that goes. But Otis broke out of Otis's movement from the sacred world of black music to the secular world of black music, like so many other people of his generation, came through these talent shows that were a very popular sort of form of amateur entertainment in places like Macon and everywhere else. I mean, the most famous one, of course, was at the Apollo Theater in New York. He started entering these shows. He started winning these shows on a regular basis. The story always went that he wanted so often that they eventually told him he couldn't enter it anymore.
Right.
And that appears to be true. It's not just apocryphal. I think he won it like, you know, 12 weeks in a row or something. And they said, enough already, you know. And then he moved from that to playing with a band called Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers, which was run by Johnny Jenkins, led by Johnny Jenkins, who was a very flamboyant guitar player, not much of a singer. We don't really know how good a guitar player he was, but he was an electrifying performer. And Otis was sort of the vocalist in Johnny's band. And they made something of a living, eked out a living, playing fraternities in the South. That was their main source of income. They also played black clubs in the South, but they hardly made any money at those places. The fraternities, on the other hand, and this is where Phil Walden came into the picture, because he was literally a fraternity boy who understood the appetite for this kind of black R&B in the big Southern colleges of that era. I mean, this is, again, one of the great ironies of that period, is that in these segregated Southern universities, like the University of Georgia or the University of Alabama or Mississippi and on, these places that in some cases became battlegrounds of the civil rights movement, on Friday and Saturday night, they wanted nothing but black bands playing these fraternity dances. And so Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers got their start and made their name on this circuit. And eventually, Johnny made, I mean, this is sort of where the story moves into the Hollywood mode of narrative. Johnny eventually made an instrumental record called Love Twist, which was a kind of minor hit, and came to the attention through this sort of grapevine that Jerry Wexler sort of had instituted in the South, came to the attention of Atlantic Records, which then offered to bankroll a recording session at Stax Records in Memphis for Johnny Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Walden, who was managing the Pine Toppers at that time and also managing Otis, who had made a couple of records, by the way, earlier in 1960 and again in 1962, some in L.A. and another record called Shout Bamalama in Georgia. But these were not records that sold in any numbers. Phil Walden and this mentor of his named Joe Galkin, who was the connection to Jerry Wexler. He was Jerry Wexler's roving ambassador to the South. They came up with this scheme where Johnny was going to go to Memphis and record with the Stax band, and Otis was going to drive him there because Johnny didn't like to drive. It was originally said that Johnny didn't know how to drive. That's not true, but he didn't like to drive. So Otis was going to drive him there. And Joe Galkin, who was going to attend the session with them, was going to find some way to get Otis a chance to sing. And again, this could have been dreamed up by a, you know, not so imaginative Hollywood screenwriter. They got there. There's a wonder. Steve Cropper, who was the great guitarist in Booker T and the MGs, and a great, great friend and became a great friend and collaborator and accompanist of Otis Redding, tells the story of them arriving at the Stax studio in Memphis on noon on a sweltering Saturday afternoon in August, and the car pulls up and Johnny is greeted by the band, and Otis comes around the back of the station wagon and starts unloading all of this equipment as if they were going to do a live gig. He's taking out speakers and microphone stands and all of this sort of thing. And Cropper's first words to Otis was, he walked over to Otis and he said, that's okay. He said, we're a recording studio. We have our own microphones here, like that. And that gives some idea of their complete, their complete ignorance of mm-hmm. what they were about to get into in this way. Anyway, the session took place. Johnny, who had a notoriously fragile ego, laid out his tunes for the Stax band. Nobody acted very impressed. Johnny's fragile ego started to crumble at that point, and the session turned into a bit of a disaster. They did eventually record a couple of tunes that Stax eventually released a couple of years later, but that shows how enthusiastic they were about that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, Galkin convinced Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax, who had announced that he couldn't make a record with Johnny Jenkins and was sort of calling the session to a halt. Galkin stepped in and said, well, you know, this other fellow here, he's the singer in Johnny's band, and he has a song he'd like to sing. And this story is one that belongs to Steve Cropper. Again, he's told it many, many times and embellished it appropriately in all sorts of ways. But what it comes down to is the song turned out to be These Arms of Mine. And when Otis began singing it, Cropper said that the hair on his arms stood on end. And they eventually cut that song. And the only place where the Hollywood narrative falls apart is that it wasn't an instant hit. It actually took almost a year of incessant airplay on WLAC, the great Memphis, great Nashville R&B station, and particularly a DJ there named John Richbourne, who was one of the great R&B DJs of his era, a white man impersonating a black man on the air. John Richbourne, John R., played the song over and over and over again in return for a little piece of the publishing of it, as was common at that time. And eventually the song became a modest hit, and mm-hmm. it really established Otis as a viable singer. And most importantly, in the early part of his career, as a balladeer. And there's no particular reason to think that Otis had been a ballad singer. I mean, certainly the main repertoire of Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers when they played in fraternities would have been dance songs. They mm-hmm. would not have been ballads. But this sort of set Otis in the mode of a ballad singer for the first couple of years of his career. And then, interestingly enough, he had to break out of that stereotype. And the song that allowed him to break out of that stereotype was the original version of Respect that you played a while back. That was his breakthrough as a dance, you know, as a groove singer, as they described it.
Well, let's hear These Arms of Mine again as we conclude this segment, and then when we return, we'll get to some calls. My guest is Jonathan Gould. He's author of Otis Redding: An Unfinished Life. It's now out in paperback. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I've been loving you too long to stop now.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's a bit from Otis Redding's hit, I've Been Loving You Too Long. We're talking about the life and times of Otis Redding. My guest is Jonathan Gould. He's the author of the latest biography, published in 2017, now out in paperback, Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You were talking about how he was known or maybe had become stereotyped as a balladeer, but he was, how did he get to become, was he a lyricist or a songwriter, both? How did he get there?
He was a songwriter. I'll start by saying, like most great songwriters, I wrote a book once about the Beatles, and so I'm familiar with John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Like most great songwriters, he was also an accomplished thief. And what I mean by that is, that's what one of the things that great artists are great at is stealing ideas, stealing things from other people. In Otis's case, the stealing early on went a little further than that. The song "These Arms of Mine," which Otis's name is on, was actually written by a former sort of colleague of his that he knew in Los Angeles in 1960, named Jackie Avery. I take pleasure in giving Jackie credit for this because Otis never denied that he had taken the song from Jackie, and never denied that he'd simply put his name on it, right? And they eventually became reunited in a manner of speaking. But anyway, he was a songwriter, a halting songwriter, I guess is the best way to say at the beginning. He had an enormous, Otis had a great musical facility. He was able not only to write tunes and though almost everything he wrote contained nothing but major chords because he played the guitar in an open tuning, which was very popular among blues musicians who don't use a lot of harmonic variation in their work. When you play a guitar in open tuning, you can simply run your finger up and down the fretboard, and you get a major chord at every instance. But minor chords are a whole other matter, and Otis simply didn't use them for the most part because his guitar technique would not allow him to use them for the most part. But anyway, his great inhibition, his great, I guess you could say, weakness early on as a songwriter was that he was self-conscious about language. Here's a place where his lack of a formal education, I think, affected him. He knew that his speech was country, and as they would say in the South, and he was initially reluctant, although he overcame this, to play up that aspect of it in the way that a lot of blues, great blues singers, were happy to play up that aspect of their speech, and so writing serious lyrics, writing good lyrics, was an issue for him. The song that you just played, "I've Been Loving You Too Long," which is the culmination in many ways of his ballad style. In just the first eight bars of that tune, it's all there: Otis's voice, Steve Cropper's guitar, the sound of those horns ascending the scale, and everything. That is the Stax ballad style. The apotheosis of the Stax ballad style. But the words of that song were written by Jerry Butler, and the song was a collaboration between Otis and Jerry Butler. Jerry sort of was playing with the song, had written the song, was playing with it. Otis asked if he could record it. As so often happened, when the song initially came out, the only person credited on it was Otis Redding and then Jerry Butler's publishing company had to make a quick call to Stax Records and say, and at which point they put Jerry's name on the song also. But as he went along, he became more confident in his lyric writing. But then the next big hit that he had that same summer of 1965, that he had a hit with "I've Been Loving You Too Long," which was "Respect." Well, the lyrics to that were written by an opening act singer and future road manager of his named Speedo Sims. Speedo is still very much alive and living outside of Atlanta, and Speedo tried to record the song "Respect," and as he describes it, when he got into a recording studio, he simply froze at the microphone. He just couldn't deliver in this way. And Otis, who was there, asked Speedo if Speedo would mind if he, Otis, recorded it. Otis completely rearranged it with the Stax band. We don't know what the real original version of "Respect" sounds like, but it surely sounded quite a bit different from Otis's version of it. But there again, this is an instance of somebody else supplying the sort of the lyric inspiration, and it really wasn't one of the many components of the tragedy of Otis's premature death was that it was only in the last 6 months of his life that he firmly embraced the idea, I suppose you could say, that lyrics matter, began to write lyrics with a confidence that matched his musical confidence, which had always been there. And the very last sort of great spate of songs that he recorded immediately before his death, the most prominent of which, of course, is Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay, which Otis very definitely wrote, and which is a great lyric, a beautifully written lyric.
Fabulous, yes.
That was something that was just beginning to happen in his creative life. And when I say it's a component of the tragedy of his death, there's no telling what he would have produced if he had been able to continue with that newfound confidence as a lyric writer.
Deborah in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. How are you folks doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Very well. Hi, Deborah.
Good. I had a question. I'm 60 years old. I go back to the 60s, being a kid, listening to the music. And I was wondering, to what extent did Otis Redding have control over his music and his legitimate earnings? I'm thinking of the more accomplished, of course, at the time, Ray Charles and James Brown. But also, some artists were getting more and more aware of the need to control their music and how much they got, et cetera. And did his wife, a widow, did she get any remaining monies over time?
Yes, it's a great question and a very important question. So when I said that Otis learned at the knee of James Brown, Otis toured with James Brown in 1963 and had the opportunity to see the way James, well, first of all, ran his whole business, ran his show. And as everybody knows, James really ran his show. And James was one of the people who impressed upon him, fortunately, the importance of publishing, which was a dimension of the music business that particularly most black artists, but a great many white artists also, really didn't understand at that time. So the simple answer to your question is that early on, beginning with a new contract that he signed with Stax Records in 1965, actually owned a piece of his publishing. And what that meant was that that combined with the fact that the people who ran Stax Records, Jim Stewart and Estelle, while they had many deficiencies as record company, as label owners, both of them started out as bank employees, and one of their great virtues was they were scrupulously honest. There's a great story that Steve Cropper tells that of being at some kind of a music business, a DJ conference in 1965, where they met up with the Supremes and Cropper and Otis, and they were chatting with the Supremes, and of course the Supremes at that point were just about the most successful act in the world, aside from the Beatles. Maybe they'd had this incredible string of hits, and they were astonished to hear one of the Supremes mention the fact that they'd never seen a royalty statement. they didn't know what that was exactly at Motown. In the case of Otis and Stax, again, every penny that he was due, I think it's fair to say, certainly from on the record company end, he was paid. And as a result, his family when he died was left in very good circumstances. His widow Zelma, who's still very much alive and a very vital personality, who lives in Macon today in the same house that they bought together in 1965, the family is well off. Zelma has invested the original money that was left to her by Otis very intelligently, and they continue to receive royalties for his work. So that tragic dimension of so many black artists of that and previous of Otis's and previous generations has not that hasn't been an issue in their lives. That isn't to say that Zelma hasn't had to fight for there are wonderful stories of people using one of Otis's songs in a television show or something like that, and getting an indignant phone call from Zelma saying, I'm just calling up to make sure that you filed here. Your loyalty statements. But going back to one other part of the question, Otis, simply by virtue of the power of his personality, was by common consent the unofficial producer of almost all of the records he made. So that's to say that his creative control was just about absolute. That's not to say that he wasn't playing with a great band, which made all sorts of great suggestions, and that he wasn't often collaborating with a fellow songwriter like Steve Cropper, who had a tremendous influence on some of the tunes and some of the arrangements. But particularly in the sort of signature aspect of the Stax sound, which was the horn sound of Stax records, the way horns were used on them. And in Otis's case, rare at the time, horns were used almost as a replacement for a female backup chorus, which, of course, ever since Ray Charles had been the standard in terms of the accompaniment of male black vocalists. Otis never recorded with a female backup chorus. One was added to I've Got Dreams to Remember after he died, but that's the only instance of that. And the horns played that role. And everybody who worked, all of those horn players say the same thing, which is that he was the author of those horn lines. Wayne Jackson, who was his trumpet player, and I always love to picture this because Otis, as I said, was a very big man. He was like 6'2" and had an imposing physical presence. Wayne was a short, rather slight, white trumpet player from West Memphis, Arkansas. And Wayne describes how Otis, when they were recording these horn lines, Otis would get in your face, Wayne says, and he'd sing those horn lines to you until you thought you were going to come out of your shoes, was the way he described it. And I can just picture that. So he was, Otis was a commanding figure, and he was in command of his career. And that's all the more remarkable when you, as I say, when you think about the circumstances, the social circumstances that he came from, where, it was very hard for a black man of his generation to be in control, much less in command of anything.
Interesting distinction. Thanks for that call. It is the 50th anniversary of the release of Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. Set the scene for us. What was going on in his life at that time when he wrote it? You just described kind of the transition as a lyricist, from kind of being a great thief to finding his own voice. How did it differ?
Well, all sorts of things were happening in Otis's life in the second half of 1967, which is when that song was written. He had this spectacularly successful reception in Britain, France, and Scandinavia when he toured there in the spring of that year. People just went wild over them. And there too, he went with Booker T and the MGs and the Stax Horns, and they all said the same thing, that they'd been living in this little bubble of Memphis, Otis less so than the rest of them, but they'd been living in this little bubble of Memphis, and they went over there and they were treated like they were rock stars. That had never happened to them before. And so Otis in particular was gaining a sense of his power, the power of his music over people, and I mean that both in an emotional sense and in a commercial sense. And then he came back from Europe and had this spectacular triumph at Monterey with an audience that was just emerging. I mean, we now think of the so to speak white audience for rock. For progressive rock, for rock as an art form, sort of became the basis of the commercial explosion of the record business in the late 60s and 1970s. But Monterey was sort of the inauguration of that audience. Not just for people like Otis, but for the record company executives who were there and thought, oh my goodness, look at all of these long-haired hippies who are living for this music. They're going to buy a lot of records. So he had that experience. And then he had a very successful tour that summer, and that same summer, Aretha covered Respect with her incomparable version of it. And suddenly, Otis was the author of a million-selling record, which he had never had a record of his own be that successful. And as a result of this, he was suddenly sort of catapulted into a new level of confidence, I guess is the mm-hmm. best way to describe it.
Jonathan Gould, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jonathan Gould, author of the 2017 Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. It's now out in paperback. And we will settle on the show with Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come out.